welcome you to another edition of El Paso Primetime. And on this Father's Day weekend, the producers thought that the following segment would be rather apropos to replay. It's a conversation between a father and his son, both of whom have served in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, both of whom are decorated for their service to our country. Moderated by Louis Sines, here's a conversation with Dick Schwein and his son Rick that takes us back to late February 2012.
Good afternoon, I'm Louis Sines. Joining us today are FBI agents Richard Schwein and Rick Schwein Jr., and Dick Schwein, as we affectionately known him, and he was a special agent in charge here in El Paso from 1987 until 1994. And his son, Dick, is an agent in the counterterrorism division. And they're here to talk a little bit about their careers, but about something very special. The FBI instituted an honorary medals program in 1989 as a way of recognizing exceptional duty by the agents, law enforcement personnel. And there were four medals in the program intended for personnel. That was the FBI Star, the FBI Medal of the Meritorious Achievement, FBI Shield of Bravery, and the FBI Medal of Valor. And one additional medal, the FBI Memorial Star for surviving relative when a death has occurred in the line of duty. And the reason we have these two gentlemen here is because Dick and Rick are the only father-son agents to receive the Medal of Valor. Gentlemen, congratulations, and thank you very much for being with us here. It's an honor.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Rick. First of all, as the son of an FBI agent, tell me a little bit about when you were little. Did you sort of know what he was doing or what kind of job he had when you made the decision to go into, or how did you get involved in this?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I think growing up, I grew up in an FBI family. So we were constantly around FBI agents and their families and other law enforcement officials and their families. So you know, sort of from a very early age, that culture of service is a part of your everyday life. And yeah, it was kind of neat. My friends all knew my dad was an FBI agent. He coached our little league team, and he'd cheer for a play, and because he'd come right from work, and the suit jacket would flip over his revolver, and it's kind of hard to hide it at that point. But I grew up listening to these agents get together on social occasions talking about the mean streets of Philadelphia. And, you know, I think from a very early age, I knew that I wanted to be involved in public service. I knew that I wanted to be around people like my dad. And initially, I resisted joining the FBI and joined the United States Army. And I had absolutely nothing to talk about at family gatherings, because everybody in my immediate family had worked for the Bureau except myself. So ultimately, my path brought me to the FBI.
Now, what about because, again, as I mentioned, when we're kids, you know, we watch television shows and we emulate that and be like that and play that. And they even had, you know, toys that, you know, where you could have like a little shoulder holster and all that stuff. When you saw some of those shows, did you think about sometimes the danger that your father was in?
You know, when you're a kid, you don't think about danger. You think you're immortal. And when you're in your 20s and 30s and even into your 40s, I think you think there's a certain level of invincibility. It's only after you do put yourself in danger and find yourself in harm's way and you get the wisdom that comes with getting older that you realize that it's a serious business. And, you know, we have a number of FBI martyrs, a number of agents that have lost their lives as a result of an adversarial action. And they are memorialized in all of our field divisions. So it's around you. And in fact, one of the early experiences that I had, first of all, your comment about the television shows, the FBI with Ephraim Zimbalist,
yes,
Jr. was mandatory viewing in the Schwein household. you know, Saturday nights, Dad popped the popcorn, everybody sat around the TV and listened to him as he critiqued all the inaccuracies. So I just wanted to make sure that we had that inculcated very early. But one of the individuals that influenced us was actually a neighbor of ours who was a Camden County police officer who, as a very young age, I just knew as Officer Woody. His first name was Woody, and he had a young family. He lived a couple houses down, and he and Dad would occasionally get together and play chess and talk about the job. And I would be around. And one evening he took me out. They had take-home patrol cars. And one evening he took me out and let me sit in the patrol car and listen to radio calls and flip the siren. So he was a neighbor who was a law enforcement officer. He was killed in the line of duty while we were in Philadelphia. Obviously a big deal in the funeral. I remember seeing it on TV with all that line of blue and red lights that seems to stretch to infinity as the local law enforcement community honored one of their fallen. And I think even at that early age, I think I was probably about 10 years old at the time, I knew that that's the kind of people that I wanted to get up and go to work with every single day. So that's how you get influenced to seek public service as part of an FBI family.
And, of course, as part of the FBI family, sometimes as I was discussing before the interview, when I was in television news, sometimes, it's a 24/7 job. But Dick Schwein is here with me, and senior, and he was the special agent in charge here in El Paso from 1987 till 1994. Now, Dick, as far as your joining the FBI, and we heard from Rick as far as, what influenced him. And you were able to, of course, watch some of those shows as well, The Untouchables, and read about the mob and the gangster. And it seemed like everybody thought that that's all the FBI did, is just deal with gangsters. How did you get influenced to become part of the FBI?
Well, I have a slightly different story. I graduated from high school and went off from a little town in Ohio, a little country town, and went off to a Quaker college to be a history teacher. They had a work-study program. You worked 3 days in the factory, and you went to school 3 days, and a recession came along, and there was no more money to go to school. But the FBI was recruiting clerical employees. If you were a male at that time, and you worked for the FBI and went to college, you could possibly become an agent. So I went to Washington, D.C. at, I think I was 19, 1957, and to the big city, and I worked for the FBI. Because I could talk, they made me a tour leader. So I took all the public on the tours and showed them the gangster era and the laboratory and the agent's shooting. And I met Rick's mother, who was a brand new employee. And about 8 weeks later, we got married. So then I got serious at school and was commissioned an agent. They transferred us to Cincinnati, and I graduated from the University of Cincinnati. Went to Birmingham in the Civil Rights Wars in 67, and then to Philly, where we stayed 9 years.
As far as you working in this legacy with J. Edgar Hoover, did you ever get to meet the man? And were you at all intimidated by, getting to run into the big boss?
Yes. Yes and yes. I met him twice. I will tell you this quickly, the stories. The first time I was a tour leader, and we took, 100,000 or more people a year on the famous FBI tour. And sometimes the tourists would say, I'd like to meet the director. And you said, well, certainly, if he's available, he'll be delighted to meet you, which wasn't really so. But sometimes, once in a while, Mr. Hoover would decide to meet the public. And you always feared that would happen, young. But we had a drill. So you took the tourists, in my case, it was a couple from Iowa. Don't remember their names, but I remember they were from Iowa, and they wanted to meet Mr. Hoover. We went up to the outer office, which is where you took them, all the trophies. And then Sam Noisette, guy who ran his office, would come out and say, Mr. Hoover's in a meeting. We're very sorry. And that would satisfy them. But this day, he said Mr. Hoover would be delighted to meet them. And my knees started shaking because who knows? You did not want to upset the director. So I walked, and I knew the drill. We walked in the door, and I said, good morning, Mr. Hoover. And he said, good morning, Mr. Schwein. And I almost passed out. How did he know my name? Well, he sent the name in, and he shook hands. Out the door we went. The second time, an assistant director decided I should be the scout leader for the FBI Boy Scout troop. That was it. And the assistant director, Carthy Deloach, said, you don't seem to understand. We want a scout leader. You're articulate. You're a tour leader. You want to be an FBI agent. I said, I'll be delighted to be the scout leader. They did not tell me that the Boy Scout troop was at the reformatory, the D.C. reformatory in Laurel, Maryland. And I had arsonists, a couple murderers, and they're all teenagers. And somebody at FBI headquarters said, you know what? It would be delightful if we brought the scout troop in, fed them in the cafeteria, gave them the tour, and let them meet Mr. Hoover. And I thought, that should never happen. These are criminals, for the love of God. But I was overruled. So we brought them in from Laurel with their guards. They were spit-shined up a little bit, and I said, now, fellas, be very nice. I know one of them was going to cuss at him, spit on the floor, or do any one of a million things. When I was at the scout meetings, they couldn't have hatchets, and they took the spear off the flags because they might stab you, you see. They were delightful. First, we took them to the firing range, and they shot the machine gun. We said, now, fellas, we don't want to come back down here. So now they were good. And he was gracious to them, shook hands with all these young people, and they were properly awed, and I survived.
Now, we talked a little bit about September 11th. I remember that we had yourself, one of the retired generals, and a professor, and somebody else to talk about September 11th and what happened then. And one of the things that you talked about is how things had changed over the years from the time you were an agent and the way they are now. And, of course, Rick, your son, has experienced some different things from what you saw. And one of the things that I remember that comes out is that nobody expected terrorists to use our own airplanes as missiles.
No, they did not. And, of course, we'd had airplane hijackings for since Cuba. And usually the plane flew, they landed, the people got off, the plane came back. But these people hijacked airplanes with box cutters, of all things. Amazing. Shouldn't have happened, but it did. But the FBI has changed. The FBI always changes. It changed when Mr. Hoover took over. It changed from when I was a young agent to when I was an agent in charge. And it's had a huge change since Rick's been an agent.
I think one of the things that has allowed the FBI to grow into the institution that it's become is that we're very adept at change, that we're very good at shifting our priorities and working those things that are most important to the American public and to the Congress of the United States. Whether those things were in the gangster era of the 1930s, whether it was chasing Nazi saboteurs during World War II, or during my career dealing with things like the savings and loan debacle, the war on drugs where Congress gave us Title 21 jurisdiction along with DEA, and we started going after drug cartels, whether it's the battle against organized crime, the battle against violent crime when the country saw a spate of violent carjackings and Congress again turned to the FBI and said, what are you doing about this? To the current dynamic, which was brought on by the events of 9/11, which probably is one of the bigger watershed events in the history of the FBI. And I've heard Director Mueller talk about this, and he tells a story where shortly after 9/11, he was briefing President Bush as part of the National Security Council about what the FBI was doing concerning the investigation into the attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and the plane that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And he was walking through all the things that we had done to identify the perpetrators, all the evidence that we had collected, all the leads that we were covering. And President Bush cut him off and said, and I'm paraphrasing, I wasn't there, of course, said, we expect that the FBI will do all those things better than any other law enforcement organization in the world. What I want to know is what is the FBI doing to prevent the next attack? So our director, who had only been in that job a week prior to 9/11, made some strategic decisions on the direction that the FBI needed to go in. And over the last 10 years, we've gotten a lot better at our intelligence functions. So we've gone we used to be more case-driven, investigation-driven. And today's dynamic, we're much more threat-driven. We try to identify threats to either national security or criminal threats that impact our economy or impact on our safety and security, and then align our resources to counter those threats. Prosecution obviously being one of the tools that we can utilize to thwart that particular threat. So it's just a different way of viewing the problem that takes some different skill sets. When I came into the FBI, we hired lawyers and accountants. Today we're looking for people with computer skills, hard science skills, intelligence backgrounds.
Languages.
Language skills in exotic languages, Pashto, Arabic, Farsi. You know, the world's globalized. The advent of air travel and the internet has made the reach of criminals, terrorist organizations, and foreign intelligence services much broader. In order to counter that, we need to have a workforce that's better prepared to deal with crime on a global level.
I know that both of you do not like, and some people do not like to toot their own horn, but you all are the only father-son team to ever receive the Medal of Valor. And for people who may not know what the Medal of Valor is, would you care to tell us about that and how that came about and what exactly you had to do? Of course, just tell us what you can.
We'll
start with you, Dick.
I'll defer to the elder, Schwein.
He got it first.
The Medal of Valor, actually, they started thinking about giving medals after the infamous Miami shootout where we had two agents killed and five wounded by a couple of rogue bank robbers. At the time, I was an inspector in the FBI, and I did the investigation of that shootout. And one of the agents who was gravely wounded with a bone sticking out of his arm, lying under a car, woke up and put to death both of the robbers who were about to back their car over a wounded agent. So his actions were just beyond any
call of duty.
So I wrote that up, and then other agents wrote up other things, and they came up with a Medal of Valor, I think in 89, but then they went back and looked at some old cases, because the one I got was for actions in Cleveland Division in 1984.
Are you allowed to talk about that?
Oh, sure.
Okay. We would love to hear that.
Well, it was a lot different than Rick's. His lasted longer than mine did, the event. But in any event, on a February day in northern Ohio, which is dark and cold, we got a call that a vice president of a motorcycle, of a pagan, yes, the Pagan Motorcycle Gang, who was wanted for murder and drug trafficking, was in northern Ohio. His nickname, his alias was Tiny, because he was 6'2" and 360 pounds, and said he wouldn't be taken alive. But agents in Wilmington, Delaware, said that his wife had loaded a U-Haul truck and was en route from Wilmington to a truck stop on the Ohio-Pennsylvania border to meet him and his girlfriend, wife and girlfriend, very nice people. So I was the second in command of the Cleveland office at the time, the assistant agent in charge, and my boss, who's deceased, God rest his soul, now said, let's saddle up and go get him. So we turned out the SWAT team and the surveillance team and went to this huge truck stop just in Ohio across the state line. And it's several hundred trucks, a motel, a shopping center, fuel things. So we set up a command car at a road leading down on Interstate 80, but we could see out over the whole thing and put the troops in, because that's what troops do. We were the bosses, myself, the agent in charge, and the senior resident agent out of Youngstown. And we probably had 30, 40 agents in there. Well, unfortunately, they slipped Tiny and his wife and girlfriend, and we knew they were in a Chrysler Cordoba, two-door car. They slipped out, and we were standing there at the side of the road with our radios in our hands, and this Chrysler Cordoba drove by us on Interstate 80 with two women in the front and this huge guy in the back seat. And the boss said, that's them. So we got in our car, my car, and onto Interstate 80. It's getting dark. It's cold. And the boss is on the radio screaming for the troops to come do their job. But he says, we're going to lose him, so pull him. So we put up the bubble gum, the light, turned on the siren, and the lady driving pulled nicely over the side of the road, and we pulled in behind them. I had a shotgun, and Mickey Roberts, the other agent in the back seat, had an M16, and the boss had his pistol, his revolver. And we got out to yell FBI, and Tiny heaved up in the back seat of the Cordova. He filled the whole back window. Our lights could illuminate. And he had a submachine gun, and he opened fire. And the bullets went fop, fop overhead, which is not a nice sound. You do know, though, that you hear them, they're by you. And the good Lord didn't want any FBI agents in heaven that day. So he had the breech of his weapon down, and the fifth round smokestack, that is, the cartridge bounced back up and jammed the mechanism of his submachine gun. And we, of course, returned fire, and that was the end of Tiny. He was deceased on the scene. We didn't put a scratch on either of the women, and it was a horrifying. It lasted about maybe 30 seconds, and it seemed like it lasted about a year and a half because you get tunnel vision. None of us had the recollection of the person next to us shooting. Didn't hear anything. I'm shooting a shotgun, and I knew it fired because I saw flame come out. It's dark. But and then the adrenaline runs out and so on. But
the reality sets in.
Yeah, and we wrote our reports, and the shooting team came out and said that you did the right thing. And the U.S. I mean, when an FBI agent shoots someone, you go through a lot of paper and investigations, and that's proper. But they said we were good guys, and we forgot about it. Then years later, after retirement, they called me and said, "You're getting the Medal of Valor." So we went to Washington and got the Medal of Valor. It was sort of neat.
Congratulations.
And he called and said, no, he came up from Charlotte. Yeah. Rick came up from Charlotte, too. And then I went to his, Mom and I went to his awards ceremony. And they had us both on stage because we were the only two to do that years apart. But his is more exciting.
Okay, Rick, your turn.
I don't know if it was more exciting, and I'll preface.
He's being humble.
I'll preface this by saying that during the event that I was involved in, I didn't do anything that any other FBI special agent wouldn't have done under different circumstances. You know, we're very well trained, and I just reacted according to my training. My event was very different, and I think it underscores the difference in the FBI post 9/11. The event that I was involved with occurred overseas in Sana'a, Yemen, where I was assigned as the legal attaché, the FBI agent at the embassy in Yemen. And the role of the legal attaché is to be the director's representative. And my responsibilities were for Southern Arabia and the Horn of Africa. And I worked as part of the country team, and I developed liaison with those foreign intelligence services and law enforcement agencies in those countries. In order to do the things that I described earlier, where you're trying to combat terrorism, crime, and other issues that are of interest to the United States by developing those key relationships in an overseas environment. So my event was an attack on the American embassy by al-Qaeda. It was a coordinated attack that occurred on September 17th, 2008. The al-Qaeda operatives, there were seven of them, in two vehicles that were rigged as vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, car bombs. And they attempted to breach the embassy wall. They came into the embassy, shot the guard force at the embassy gate, got access into the outer perimeter, exploded the first car bomb with a suicide driver up against a Republic of Yemen government security gun truck, basically a pickup truck with a Dishka 51 caliber machine gun mounted on it. And then I think their plan was to try to breach the embassy wall and then drive the second vehicle in and attack the chancery where all the Americans worked. Because the embassy was constructed to pretty good standards, the post-East Africa standards, they were unsuccessful in breaching the wall. So they were out basically in the outer perimeter of the embassy, and they ended up killing six or seven of the Yemeni guard force as well as a number of civilians, including an American citizen who was in the consular line that morning. I had just gotten into the embassy. When the attack occurred, I knew when the first VBID went off exactly what it was. I had a couple of other FBI employees, a language specialist and an office manager at the office at the time. I instructed them to take cover. I took cover myself and called FBI headquarters and let them know that the embassy was under attack. And they put me on hold, which was interesting. I reported to the Marine Post 1 that our people were safe. They asked me to do a couple other things to get accountability for people on the floor that I was on. And shortly afterwards, Marine Post 1 called back and said, "Hey, sir, can you meet the regional security officer? He's in charge of the physical security embassy, and bring your weapon." So I grabbed my kit and I met the RSO, who's an extremely talented and brave individual, a guy named Nick Calora. And Nick said, "Hey, we got people trapped in outbuildings that are unsecure." And the embassy chancery was the hard point. That's where you wanted to get people in an attack. So he said, "We need to go get them, and we need to get them to the chancery." And I said, "Okay, when you say we, what's that entail?" He said, "You and I." And so we talked about how we were going to do it, how we were going to move. And Nick had been a law enforcement officer and on a SWAT team. I had spent a dozen years on an FBI SWAT team, and prior to that was an Army Ranger. So we were pretty comfortable with tactics. And so we talked about how we were going to do it, and then we went out in the midst of the attack and moved people from positions where they were vulnerable to positions of safety while under fire. And the bad guys all committed suicide. They blew up the second VBIED unsuccessfully. It detonated outside of the embassy. They never made it into the embassy perimeter, into the inner perimeter of the embassy. Four of the attackers were wearing suicide vests, and they all detonated their vests. So once we accomplished the task of getting everybody undercover, then I had a rather large crime scene to have to work with the Yemeni government service, and spent the bulk of that day and several ensuing days trying to figure out, you know, what we had, and also trying to gain an advantage to prevent a follow-on attack. So pretty exciting. Got a little sporty, but much different than my father's event. I didn't discharge my weapon. The medal was awarded to me for leaving the safety of the chancery and getting between the terrorists and American citizens and Foreign Service nationals who were exposed.
Well, congratulations to both of you, and thank you very much, both of you, to your service to our country. We appreciate it. We've been visiting with Dick and Rick Schwein, and they are the only father-son pair to get the Medal of Valor from the FBI. Dick Schwein, Sr., he was the special agent in charge here in El Paso from 1987 till 1994, and Rick is an FBI agent working in the counterterrorism division in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roy.
This conversation took place in late February 2012. We certainly wish you and yours a very happy Father's Day weekend. Stick around. Louis Sines is up next with his own show, Perspectives. Tune in again next Saturday for another edition of El Paso Primetime.